It's quite an honor to be here. Do I not? We're all... It's an honor to be here among people who have carried such love for their work into their lives. So I can't imagine, the bottom line is I can't imagine remembering 130 different kinds of beans, their blooms, their leaves, their shape, they say bridge is good for it. I think that remembering beans is good too. I'm Sarah Fritchner, and I think that you know everybody or should know them by the food they cook so far. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about myself and why I'm here. In 1994, I believe, I started a farmer to restaurant festival. It was a food festival on the Ohio River. We called it the Ohio Valley Harvest Festival, and we brought farmers together with restaurateurs for one day. There's a lot of carries involved in part of it, but we sort of decided that we could not force farmers and restaurateurs together for more than a day at first, because there was so much getting to know each other's problems and solutions to those problems. It was just a monumental task. So I started a festival. I helped start a festival that brought these farmers and restaurateurs together for one day. The farmers would bring their product to the restaurateur. The restaurateur would cook it. They would set up booths at this food festival side by side, and consumers could come in, taste the butternut squash soup, buy the butternut squash, and go home. So we were hoping that the consumers could practice buying from a farmer, which is still odd. Most people are used to buying at supermarkets and having it be a very impersonal activity, and not understanding that a raspberry in January is probably not the best choice in January. So we were trying to educate everyone about seasonal produce, about buying locally, and do it in a party setting. The advantage to this was not only did the farmers and the restaurateurs get to know each other gradually and in a party setting, but the media had access to rural thinking, rural problems, rural people. But they didn't have to go out of town to do it, so they could just come down to the Belvedere and talk and then get their story and leave. And we got a lot of radio and a lot of TV, so it was not a huge moneymaker for anybody, and we tried to explain it to them for that. Now, so that being one day, that was great, but what we really wanted to do was provide a living for farmers over time, over a summer, over a season, growing season. And so, in addition, I have been working on supporting farmers markets in the Louisville area, which we now have 13. We started with 4. And for better or for worse, markets in the Louisville area are spread out. We don't have a central market like Lexington does, and sometimes that just kills me, and sometimes I think it's the only way. So fortunately, I'm not in a decision-making situation. I'm in a support situation, and as a result of that, my newspaper, for some reason, pays for 5,000 maps to be printed every year. They just do it. It's in the budget now. I don't know how that happened, but that's the map of all. And we print this in the paper the first when it first comes out. We send these 5,000 copies. We advertise them all summer long. I send them out. Nobody has to send in a self-addressed stamped envelope. This is Gannett News. I don't know. But they're paying for it all. And we get the times and places that where they are, when they're open, the days they're open, where they're located on the map. We have a ripening chart as at least a nod to helping educate people. I don't know, people are still mad that they can't get corn in June. But I found out, if nothing else, I found out this is a really long, gradual process. And for the person who asked what can we do? How can we help? Everyone can help. Everyone can do something. And I hope you do, because it is a really long, hard process. And that's what we're here to talk about today, I hope. I've got a lot of questions. And I've got to say, I got started in this after reading all about Alice Waters and how she got all this local produce and it was so tasty. And I come from a nutrition background, so I put together that, it took a while, but I put together that you can eat well and eat nutritiously. You know, in this country, we sort of have this legacy of if it tastes good, it must be bad for you. So I sort of knew some way that didn't have to be true. But I didn't really understand it until 1994, and I went to Italy, and I had a cherry tomato that tasted good, and I went, oh, okay, this is what a good piece of produce tastes like. So I thought, well, if we could get local produce to taste this good to the people, people would eat better. So it's really kind of the white nylon uniform part of me that wants to have good-tasting produce. But in the end, we are all better for it. In any measure. So I thought, well, we'll just, Katie and I, well, we'll just get all farmers together, and we'll get all the researchers together, and this is going to be great. And so this is how I'll introduce Kathy Carey. She had the first meeting at her restaurant that I worked really in the city. I can say that pretty sure. And, you know, it was a wonderfully romantic restaurant. All the lights flipped on, drinking hot coffee, middle of the morning, you know, the most unromantic setting in the world, and a whole bunch of people got together, and the farmers complained that they couldn't get guarantees from the chefs, and the chefs complained they couldn't get tomatoes in January, and everybody broke up, and it was just, you know, it was just the cold truth was there. This was not going to be easy, and it was not going to be something off Martha Stewart. It was going to be a long, hard trial. So, and it's really killed me ever since then, and I've been going to seminars of all kinds since then, and it's just killed me how we'll get the president of the Organic Research Association is a friend of mine, but he gets up and says, yes, well, we're funding, you know, a study of date growers in Southern California when they're going to be growing their dates organically, blah, 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 you know, and I'm like, in the Ohio Valley, in Kentucky, we have more flora and more fauna than any other state in the country. That's mold, mildew, insects, I mean, anything that can grow on a plant or damage a plant, we got more of them in Kentucky than anywhere else in the country. You know, organic dollars ought to be headquartered in our state, because we've got all the problems. The humidity is so bad. So again, this reality thing starts coming. You know, we cannot eat organically in Louisville, Kentucky. It just can't be done, not at this day and time. So what can we do? Where can we go? How can we start to solve the problems of getting chefs together, chefs who want every tomato lined up like eggs in a basket, the right size, the sliceability, all that stuff that we've all been told all our lives is what we want. How can we start to change all this? So that has ended up being a monumental problem. And so we're going to try, what I'm going to do today is ask people a lot about their challenges, the chefs and their challenges with farmers, the chefs and their challenges with markets, the farmers and their challenges with markets and chefs, so that we can begin to understand what impedes the progress of a successful farm market or many markets or bringing the market to the back door of the chef and maybe learn, if we're interested, how to solve some of those problems. So Kathy cooked the lunch today. She worked all day yesterday. Nobody's gotten to meet her. At Ajax, were you introduced?
I had my partners were entirely responsible for everything that happened at Ajax.
Well, he's a wonderful cook. We ate at his restaurant last night, and that was wonderful.
Fabulous.
John owns a city grocery on the square and has been sort of shepherding all this through. Kathy lives in Louisville, Kentucky, and has many credits to her name, including being on the Martha Stewart Show, the Today Show, featured food and wine, Bon Appetit, yada, yada, yada. So I will add to her list of credits that holding that first meeting where the grim reality of eating locally and eating seasonally came to bear on all of us. And she has sort of held the torch for the restaurants We have a great restaurant community in Louisville, and they are doing, many of them are doing their best to support the effort. But Kathy was the first. So I'm glad to welcome her to the panel. John Kurtz is the chef owner, co-owner of the City Grocery, and he also helped get the Oxford Market started. So he's got, he's got the experience of wanting fresh local produce in his restaurant, coming from that background of cooking with fresh local, and also wanting the retail market here and thinking that that's a necessity in the community. Johnny Clark, we've already met. Bill Best, we got to hear more from. And so I'm just going to start by asking a few questions of these people, and then I would like for you guys to also ask questions, because what I'm really doing here is trying to gather information that I can take home to make my markets better. So I hope that you guys can do the same thing. And my first question is for John Kurtz, because I know that it's close in your mind. You've had one season of market. Tell me what surprised you what impediments surprised you when you were trying to open the market. You thought this would be a good idea. What sort of bumps in the road did you hit when you were opening the Oxford Farmers Market?
Power of the microphone. How can I keep this short? We were fortunate that we had at our disposal the blueprint of the Crescent City Market. We did a significant amount of research into fledgling markets, and I think we spent a lot of time. We had a good core group of people that got together and all had sort of the same vision. I think the first problem we ran into, other than when we could all get together simultaneously, was trying to corral farmers for the first time, finding growers that could understand what we were trying to do. There in the surrounding county area are a number of growers. A lot of guys are, I think, accustomed to growing the very same things that they've grown for their entire lives. And the older guard, I think, they had a really set in stone idea of what the market was, or what a market would be. And that was, I think, prior to the reemergence of the farmer's market, that market was your alternative to the grocery store, where you cut out the middleman, you bought your produce at absolute rock bottom prices, and got in and got out. The reality of the situation, I think, is that in the reemergence of the market, we have almost entirely redefined what people are coming to the market for. They're now coming to more of a boutique setting, in that they're prepared to pay a greater price than at the supermarket so that they can buy fresh produce that's grown locally. They can taste the soil that it's come from. They know they stand on it every day. They see familiar faces from the people that they buy from. And I think quickly come to an appreciation that their produce that comes from the store frequently comes from halfway around the world. That you see a very quick and almost painful learning curve that people go through coming to understand seasons. And I think Sarah said something earlier. I mean, people stomp their feet in September because they can't find any more corn or blueberries, but quickly come to understand that that there's a season, and rather than coming to the local farmers market with a set idea of what they're going to have for dinner, they let the offerings then tailor, what they're going to do. And so I think the long and long of what I'm trying to say is initially trying to foster the interest of growers that have had a preconceived notion of what the market was going to be like, quickly gave way by word of mouth to the fact that it was potentially lucrative, that there are certainly other early and late season crops that these guys can get interested in, sell without threatening what they are most accustomed to doing. I mean, I remember really early on when we rolled out sugar snap peas when we first opened the market, and it absolutely blew my mind that we had some of the older guys that grow peas and corn that would come over and kind of pull us aside and say, "What are these things? And what do you do with them? I'm going to grow some of those next year. I'll see you in the spring." And you know, with that, it's really inspiring to see that, you know, you've got guys that are going to try something new. They're going to be back early, and we had an incredible concentration of people in the middle of the growing season that we really anticipate seeing in the beginning of our second season. Some of these guys out earlier with something different. So that's it.
Don't settle down. I'll be back. Kathy, I know that farmers, especially in Kentucky, we have the third highest number of farmers. Kentucky has the third highest number of farms in the country after Texas and Missouri. So that a lot of that has to do with the tobacco allotment. And, of course, that's beginning to crumble. And so we're all having to come up with ideas. Half of our tobacco settlement money is going back to farmers, which is a very high percentage. Lots of states are building infrastructure and that kind of stuff with their money, but all of ours is going back to farmers, and so it's sort of up for grabs now. So we're trying to encourage people to grow food because we're the food people. So, so they're exploring that now. Kathy, I wanted to ask you what, it's hard to cook in season all the time. It's hard to use seasonal ingredients all the time. Those, it's a struggle to just make sure that you're just using those things. Also, I know that farmers grow things like Bill's tomatoes have cracks in them and they're hard to store and that kind of thing. How do you deal with all the farmers that come to you? Because you don't shop at a market, right? Your farmers deliver to you.
Our farmers all deliver to us.
How do you deal with the inconsistency in product, whether in size, the size and shape of the product itself, or its keepability, or we're assuming it's all grade A wonderful tasting, but just the oddness of all the stuff coming in and all the personalities of the farmers. Would you tell us your experience about that?
Yes, we do get imperfections, but I have three businesses, Lily's, which is our fine dining, and two Gourmet to Go's operations, and one's in suburbia and one's near Lily's, which is near downtown, and then I have a catering business. So in the growing season, the most important thing for the farmers to do show up, as I always tell them, if you have a phone, use it once a week and call me and let me know when you're coming. And the best time to come or to call me is like on a Monday or Tuesday, and then you tell me what you're bringing, and I try to buy as much as I can from the farmers, and then I call my chefs at different locations and say, "I'm sending you this on a certain day." That has been very successful because I don't care if the tomatoes aren't perfect. You know, we've got to make, you know, ratatouille, or I don't care if they're not perfect, we're making tomato soup by the, you know, 10-gallon buckets. Communication is also very important for their growing season because often if I'm doing a large party, I used to do a lot more than I do now, but, you know, 500-600 people off-premise catering, I would plan a menu before I talked to the committee planning a menu, I'd talk to my farmers, and I'd say, "What can you do?" "Well, those eggplant sandwiches you have today." Boy, they've been to a lot of charity events. But eggplant and tomatoes, a great thing that farmers would count on. How many pounds, roughly, Kathy? So that's still a huge thing with me is communicating ahead. Right now, we still, you know, we have a man that shows up guaranteed every Tuesday with at least 50 pounds of homegrown shiitakes. "How much do you want?" We don't buy them all, but I know he can get rid of them really. Few restaurants down the road, he's got them sold. Some of my farmers have come to me over the past few years. It's just really been nice. I buy, maybe it's they're selling their herbs or their baby lettuce, and I might say, Kathy, I'll say, can you grow any more? I mean, in the next season, can you offer more of this so I could buy more? And believe it or not, some of their problems have been, we need more land. And it's a beautiful thing to hear that, because obviously the one-on-one with the chef, I think, is working. When Sarah mentioned what happened in 74, the farmers and the chefs all getting together at my restaurant and everyone kind of walking out confused, three of us did try using a middleman for basically about 2 months, and the farmers were up in arms because this man would buy their produce and hold it. So it was being held for X amount of days. And, of course, the farmer wasn't getting paid directly and what the farmer deserved. It didn't last long. Chefs were unhappy, so were farmers. And so I called the farmers who I liked what they I knew what they could deliver. And since then, it's a little more difficult. But truly, when they call, as much as we can possibly buy and send out to a location, it means a lot to our customers. And our customers also, as I think around the country now, they love, I mean, farmers and farm markets have changed the way we live in all the positive way of the social, the food, where the food comes from. I think it's a vital part of what we care about, whether we're going actually to the market and buying, or you're in a restaurant reading a menu of the farmer's name and location, and then you ask your server, tell me about this place. Where is Hart County, and where is Doolin, or where's Princeton, Kentucky? It's a story, and I think people do like stories because I think food is, it's not the complexity of the food, it's just sometimes the stories that go behind of where it came from, and our farmers are truly a part of that.
Thanks. Johnny Clark's, he didn't tell you yesterday, but his background is organizing. He organized his union. So organizing a bunch of farmers can't be that hard, right? Don't answer that. You work mostly with farm markets, correct? Tell me about getting your farm produce to the market. Is distance a problem? Do you have a long way to drive? Do farmers... when I hang out in farm market crowds, the farmers talk a lot about how they can't get to the urban areas where they can get the most money. Can you address that issue at all?
Distance is important as far as farmers market is concerned. I only travel about 65 miles, but there are some folk at Crescent City Farmers Market in New Orleans who come as far as Hattiesburg and Lumberton. It takes about an hour and a half, 2 hours. You have to take consideration foods that are grown in season. And you're talking about quality, and I was listening a moment ago. The product that you grow has to be presentable. And if you have a variety of product and it's presentable, it will sell itself. Now, when it comes to organizing farmers, sometimes our customers are more of a problem than the farmer, because he's got the product and he's trying to sell it. But you have to be a little tough when it comes to some of these farmers. They'll bring you a product that isn't presentable at all. All he wants to do is just bring a group and just drop it and sell it and go on about his business. But he's got to learn to come to the market with a quality product that will sell itself and be willing to spend a little time there. You don't get a nice going price, which is usually about 80% of what you see in the supermarkets, unless you spend some time. You make more money, and you find that the shortage will occur if you got a good product, because they come in and they buy all of your product, then you have to increase production. So in order to offset this running out of a product, we found that through Southern University there in Baton Rouge, that alternative or successive planting of a product. I had been planting 20 rows of beans or peas, and When that's all gone, I'm out of business. So we decided to plant 20 rows of beans. We plant, say, 5 rows of beans every 2 weeks. We plant, instead of planting 20 rows of peppers or okra or whatever, we only plant 5. So if I have grown 5 rows of a product every 2 weeks, I will extend my harvest over a longer period of time and have and make more money. It doesn't look like it because of the quality, I mean, the amount that you're planting. But your product, if it's of good quality, and you have a constant supply of product over a longer period of time, because your best prices for produce is usually in April, May, October, and November. So by successive planting, if you come in at May, you can go all the way through to probably November down where I am. We don't have this 30-degree temperature in October. We might get it in January. But you stagger your planting, grow a variety of product. Don't plant what you see someone else planting, because you'll flood that particular market, and therefore you won't be able to get rid of your product. But find you a niche.
Do you argue? Do the farmers argue? Do they not argue with each other, but argue behind each other?
Well, the customers at this upscale market that we at usually adjust the situation. They won't buy the product. You can't force people to buy something they don't want to buy.
Right.
And a lot of customers will complain about it. Then you find some of the farmers trying to force the people to buy something that he wants to grow and sell. You can't grow what you want to grow and sell to people. Let them tell you what to grow, and you have to ask questions of your customers. What do you want? What do you need? What do you like? And respond to the needs of the customer. This is how you make your living.
Thank you, Bill. You were a charter member of the Lexington Farmers Market, correct, in 1972? And you started the Berea Market in 73, correct? The Lexington Market is one market with 20, how many farmers?
70-some
farmers. And and the Berea Market has 22 over the course of the
season.
Tell me what some of your challenges are at those markets. Maybe one challenge each. Tell me about a challenge that you haven't found a solution to that just keeps on bugging you after 20, 30 years.
The biggest challenge at the Lexington Market, where we have so many sellers, is the penhooker. The penhooker is a term that's borrowed from livestock sales, where someone will come in and borrow a pen of animals and then sell them later and during the sale and either make a killing or lose his shirt, but usually they're up on it, so they make a killing. The term is also applied to people who buy and resell at the farmer's market. When I started the Berea Market in 1973, I persuaded the city council, which allowed us to have it and gave us the space to have it, to have it growers only, and they agreed. Excuse me. I have been something of a benevolent dictator since that time, in the sense that I go out and get the people to grow, and I explain to them the rules, and generally speaking, we're all in agreement. Occasionally we'll have someone try to bring in South Carolina peaches or Indiana cantaloupes or something like that, but under pressure from the other people there, they typically see the light very quickly and move on. So that has worked pretty well. Now in Lexington, we're organized as a not-for-profit organization. We have a board of directors and our bylaws and things like this, and we sort of wrote into those bylaws. The penhookers gave me sort of a grandfather clause, I guess, that they could stay in. We still have people abuse it because it seems like those who are penhookers also like as much as possible to pretend that they actually grew it. And we have one lady in particular who could write a book on how to lie. You can go to her and say, and I've seen people 3 or 4 organize on a given Saturday, and they'll play this trick on her, and and they'll go see her and they'll say, you know, that looks like the Saddam Hussein tomato that I've been growing for, my family's been growing for the last 150 years. And she'll say, right on. She said, their family has grown for at least 200 years, that Saddam Hussein tomato. Or whatever, you choose the name, you give it a name. And I mean, she just, she buys into it and she will agree with anything you say. But she says, you know, we have grown that tomato for so long. So far as I know, her family doesn't grow anything, and they sell everything and claim to grow it. So that's a real problem, because it impinges on the credibility of all of us. However, there are a group of us who are loosely confederated who are all growers, and we're almost all from Madison County, Kentucky. And we sort of advertise ourselves as being from Madison County, and I'm from Berea, and I advertise Berea in Madison County. And so the Madison County growers are the ones who have the positive name. And most of the others, you know, as years have gone on, we have increased our trade, and most of the time they have decreased their trade. But it's still a problem, because it does impair the credibility of the entire organization. But let me say about the Lexington Farmers Market. When it was started, we're coming up on our 30th year, it was started by the lady who is now mayor, Pam Miller, as a private citizen, Pam Miller, and another lady, and I'll have to give them credit for it. They organized it and ran it for several years and did an excellent job at it, and before we then organized ourselves and took it over. But there is still this split between the pen hookers and the growers. We don't get along. We tolerate one another, basically, is how we do it. And we try to make sure that all of the new people coming in are growers, leaving the others grandfathered in, and we would be pleased if they simply admitted that they grew the stuff. They're supposed to, all of the farmers are supposed to designate where their produce comes from. Well, this simply does not happen. The Berea Market, I've persuaded almost all of the people to plant sequentially. In my son's operation, we sell tomatoes from May through November, greenhouse tomatoes grown in the ground early on, all the way through the summer, then greenhouse tomatoes starting again in a couple of weeks through November. That's our goal. We don't always have the seamless transition that we aim for, but I think the biggest problem in Berea is training enough people to grow sequentially. They tend to grow the big amount, sell it, and then they're gone. So we start out with five or six people. In July and August, we may have 20. Then September and October, we're back down to five or six, and then to two or three, and then finally to one. So people are not accustomed to doing that. Enough of them are in Lexington that we can do it, and we can maintain a top-notch market all the way through. But the Berea market peters off near the end, and people are just not accustomed to doing it. And they say, well, you know, I've never done it that way, and they're a little bit scared to try.
Did you want to say
something? Yeah. One of the things you had asked me about was the organizing of a market, somewhat like a union. I'm on the board, and we have three representatives from among the vendors that are on the board of the regional initiative that runs this market. And we have problems with farmers who bring product in that they didn't grow. And we've told them you can only sell what you grow. So we just got rid of two of them about a month ago. They start bringing things like bananas, and I know good and well they don't bring bananas. And they were growing tomatoes in that particular section, because tomatoes don't do very well in August. And they were bringing melatones, which is called, as Washington call it. But if they have complaints or problems, they go to either one of the three representatives that they have on the board to resolve that problem. And this is how we are similar to the organizing or the running of a trade union movement. We have different names for things, but basically most of those things work the same way. And we have to keep a lid on it, because there's one lady, she came in there, she had tomatoes, beans, okra, everything out of season, but we knew she wasn't growing it. And those of us who live in the area knows what can be grown at that particular time of the year.
John, can you tell me how you struggle in your kitchen in the restaurant with buying and using local produce?
Oh, wow, this is this really goes back to my first day here. I was fortunate in my early years to have had as a mentor, or as mentors, I should say, a couple of guys, Bill Neal being one, and a guy named Gerard Maris in New Orleans was another, who were both very much dedicated to working as much with local product as possible. Gerard went as far as this is when I was at with the Brennans at Mr. B's Bistro in the French Quarter, as far as actually venturing out, and this is a let me preface this by saying this is an extraordinarily busy restaurant setting, but Gerard actually ventured out into the North Shore, north of Lake Pontchartrain, to find guys that would grow for him. He had somebody who did rabbits, grew rabbits for him specifically, someone who he had grow basil for him, and got the basil grower interested in arugula, and began growing arugula for him. And he was so dedicated that he actually pursued these guys on top of a hectic schedule. When I opened City Grocery almost 10 years ago, I decided when I got here that as much as I wanted to do that, I wanted to foster the local economy by keeping as much of our money in Oxford as I could and supporting the local guys. Oxford is unique because I was the only person really that was interested in anything like this, and trying to get a whole bunch of farmers excited about trying to supply one restaurant is an incredibly difficult task. I had a very difficult time because if you get somebody that's got 7 or 8 acres of tomatoes growing and I use about 75 pounds a week, it's not going to make a dent in what these guys are growing. On the flip side of that, then you take sort of hobby growers that aren't growing enough really to supply. So I was sort of stuck in this position in between, and basically what I did for years was just sort of put the word out that anybody who came by the back door with something or wanted to call and make contact with us, that I'd take whatever comers availed themselves to City Grocery, and we did the same thing at Ajax. I mean, we sort of put the word out, and people began to trickle in here and there. For a while, we had a group of guys that spent their weekends going out and gathering local mushrooms, and we had a great supply of mushrooms. And those guys all finished grad school and moved on, and we were left without that source. And but it's an enormously difficult task in this environment. And as a result, and I hate to go ahead and disclose a secret to several of the board members that are present that run the farmers market, organizing the market was as much a selfish chore as it was anything else, guys. It helped me in the situation that I was in, gain regular contact with these guys. I've had a really good time this season taking advantage of what's left over at the market. We've had a tremendous time doing what we do, and I could go in, be in there first thing in the morning, and buy up my produce for Saturday through Tuesday or Wednesday, and buy up a significant portion of what guys were coming to the market with. But I really had a great time just sort of taking what was left from a lot of people, so that we've always had plenty at the market. But so the market really was an answer to the problems that I had had.
Being in that in-between space.
Exactly.
So how much money do you think you spend at the market every week?
I don't know if that's something that I can discuss now. I would say that that I spend on average, I buy a lot of eggs. I've been fortunate that our egg suppliers here, and so with those, I spend probably about $100 a week at the market.
And how much do you think you could spend if you weren't buying the leftovers, if you got to buy first?
I could probably spend 2-3 times that much, mm-hmm. easily.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions? Okay, good.
I'm dying to know to what extent market farm availability influenced the planning of today's menu, which was quite wonderful.
Hold on, Kim. The question was, how much did what was available affect what we had to eat today?
Your menu plan.
Well, I had to make a call down here and actually talk to John and John T to see what was available locally, trying to get as many things local as possible. And sweet potatoes came from one of John's supplier, as well did the kale. Came straight from the market this morning, the kale and mustard greens. And then I knew that eggplant was a very sort of full vegetable in Louisville, and knew that I'm sure that it would be available down here as it was, and even some Japanese.
Your host from last night hosted the eggplant this morning as well. A lot came from her garden.
And then the caramelized onion pudding is kind of a Kentucky thing. And then I did the eggs derby, the shiitake mushrooms came from here. And the country ham was not, I didn't bring anything down, but it did influence. And apples, I knew it was sort of apple season, in this part of the country, and it's always bourbon season, so. I was trying to do a connection between what I knew we have in Kentucky right now, or did maybe 2 weeks ago, and I felt for sure what Oxford had now, too. Them last year and ask if there's anything they could improve upon or new vegetables and fruits they could do. And yes, we talk. I've seen one of our farms has gone much more sort of an Asian route of what they grow. And they've based on quantities. I always try to be optimistic and say you can count on that plus a little more. But there's no contract. There's no written contract except when I've told one farmer, you know, if you sold me 400 pounds of tomatoes a week, I know I could use them. And so at least in Kathy, I never want to have that many tomatoes. I'll go, okay. I also say if someone can find someone who can can tomatoes, please help me out, and I would love to have your canned tomatoes and buy them and use them all winter too. But there's nothing written down. It's just sort of a love relationship.
And I'll just clarify, sound like you described that they always contact you. You don't call them.
Few have phones, we'll answer them. Now, truly, I can think of four of them. And it's, or they'll come when they come to their last drop off in the late fall. We spend 20 minutes just talking about the coming season, and that kind of does it.
Tom, do you want to?
Well, I have no experience with it. I mean, with this being our first season, really, with the market and the little amount of luck that I've had in the past, I really, so the answer would be no.
Go ahead.
We have chefs that buy up to 600 pounds of tomatoes per week from us, not counting 30 pints of cherry tomatoes per week as well, and they all come to the market to get them. We realized early on that we would have to persuade the chefs to come to the market, and I think they enjoy that even more because they get their pick of what's going on, especially if they get there early in the morning, and it pleases them. We've sold up to 30-some chefs last year, including 17 who ordered through one broker from Cincinnati. He came and picked up everything that they wanted. He didn't show up this year. We haven't found out what happened to him, but I've had at least 30 chefs from Lexington, and they pass the word among themselves. And frequently I'll say, oh yes, you're working at so-and-so and getting something. No, he said, No, I've traded twice since then, and the chefs in Lexington seem to move around a lot. But the same chefs continue coming, buying from us, regardless of who they're cooking for during that time. And while I have the floor, I don't know how much time I've got left. I'm going to tell you all, I'm on a crusade on taking people back to the future as soon as possible on eating. And it occurred to me, since I've been down here getting to know some of you all, I want to write a book on beans. It's going to be called Getting to Know Beans About Beans. A subtitle, A Recovery Program for Former Bean Counters.
On the availability of product that's coming to the market, we found that by placing excess whatever you have on the internet, and most of the chefs will key into that production list. And as a result, I have about 5 different customers that come in. They tell me what they want, and I have it prepared for them. When they get to the market, they're sitting on the side waiting for them to come pick it up. And then some of them I deliver to. We have about 35 large carnival organizations, and this is the 3rd year that I will be supplying all the greens and the salad greens for that affair, and that's for about 2,000 people. And you can do it. You can do it through the internet. List what you have, and you'll be giving the chef an opportunity to decide what he wants to prepare. See, it's a matter of cooperation between the two.
Go ahead.
But not contract. No, no
contract. What we have to have, what we have to be.
I am not in the South, and I go to fairly many farmer meetings, and I know it happens a lot on the West Coast. But in the South, I have not ever heard of anybody doing that. That doesn't mean nobody does it. But right now it seems like we're all coming from this level where John came from, where we're all sort of starting out, and it's just not quite codified yet. Kathleen, you have your second question. Is that your second question?
Yes.
You were on the
question.
Okay. Yeah.
Do you guys have a sense, working with your state agriculture partners, are they kind of reluctant to understand that you're doing something different than the commodity stuff?
Can I answer?
Is it the South answering some of the other areas of the country? Are you seeing
reluctant? Are your departments of agriculture reluctant to deal with you?
No.
No?
Do they seem to understand what you're doing?
Yes. Most of the regulations for food safety and of foods was written by our organization. And this is not coming out of an ag-grad college. This is coming out of a Catholic university.
So they haven't really helped you. The Catholics help you. The land grants haven't helped you.
What I'm saying is that we have more or less written the rules and the regulations for food safety for the state of Louisiana.
You're bureaucrats at work.
Yeah. And another note I wanted to say something about is the prep cooks. There's a need for prep cooks. We're finding that out now. That's people who will clean, wash, and sell foods to chefs that's already pre-prepared. And then you've got a lot of senior citizens who need someone to do this for them. I peel potatoes, I slice them. I peel carrots, I julienne strip them. I julienne strip radish. All this kind of stuff. All the chefs got to do is reach over and get it because it's already pre-prepared and it's washed and it's sanitized.
I haven't found Kentucky particularly helpful in the information they send out about what to grow is dated at best, and it also deals with the most commercial of the commercial vegetables. I mean, they really don't know how to deal with heirlooms at all. And they tell you, for example, with your beans, never let the bean appear. I mean, that's just dated. And by the way, let me say also why the bean disappeared is that the bean was adapted many years ago for mechanical harvest. They wanted it not to be broken as if it was mechanically harvested. And in Western North Carolina Farmers Market in the middle of July, Blue Lake beans will bring, mechanically harvested, will bring $7 a bushel. Greasy beans harvested by Mexican migrants will bring $18 a bushel. Greasy beans bring $45. That shows you the different values that people put on them.
Go ahead.
I have a comment on the contract question. I'm a member of Georgia Grove Co-op. With the new USDA rules on our hands, we have no idea what that's going to mean next year. But it's been certified organic from the certifier. They do contracts with restaurants and the fine dining sector. So Ann Brewer, the contact there in Covington, Georgia, and whoever asked that question is 770-786-1933. My question for any of you four, have you experienced chefs coming after growers for food waste and recipe support, or have you had any proactive programs from farms to the chefs as far as farm food waste that can get to a restaurant table?
I'm not sure I understand the question. Do you guys?
I got up real early this morning.
Means in this context.
Recipes that come off the farm that actually end up on the restaurant table, that they actually come from the grower to the chef and says, the chef quickly, I need this, this, and this, and this. The grower says, have you thought about trying this?
They're beginning to use these now, dried beans for one thing, at our suggestion.
Do we take inspiration from the farmers?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, some of our farmers will bring us gifts of their produce from the farm. Some of our farmers have become very close friends of mine, and I always go, how did you make this? And there's not a written recipe. It's like an oral thing, and we talk about it, and I have no problem putting it on the menu. And if a server says, well, where did this come from? I just say, oh, call up, his name is Bruce, call up Bruce's eggplant, smoked eggplant tapenade or something. And so, yeah, with some farmers, definitely we like sharing back and forth. As I make food, and when they come on a given day, I give them some of the foods that we've made to take home, how we interpreted the produce they brought us. It's a very much give and take.
Yeah, and I think further to that, I mean, currently there's such a sort of a return, it seems like, to the roots of American cooking that I find myself sort of constantly seeking out the stuff that I salvaged from my grandmother's their old sort of Baptist church cookbooks, and trying to really dig back into real traditional technique and ideas, and I don't know that I can say that I actually have solicited anything from our local farmers, but it's the same idea. I mean, there is really a very much a prevailing mentality right now of trying to get back to the roots of American, true American cooking, and I think that's where a lot of it is still preserved with these guys that are still cooking at home. I mean, we have just such an incredible tendency now to rely on restaurants. Thank you all very much for making our lives possible. But I think that there are a lot of us there that, not that that I ever get tired of really trying to create, but to me, I see a real trade-off between over-creating and really being able to muster up the essence of a bag full of green beans that I've gotten from the market.
I'm going to say something. In the spirit of bringing the farmer and the restaurateur together at the Harvest Festival, we had a farmer who had... he had been a commodity farmer all his life. His father had been a commodity farmer, and he had grown up a commodity farmer until somebody from Purdue came and handed him some... Southern Indiana is right across the river from Louisville, so we consider Southern Indiana part of our area. And somebody from Purdue had come and given him some Mediterranean melon seeds, and he always grew watermelon, and he kind of had a thing for them. So he grew these Mediterranean melons,
and he ended up selling them to restaurants. To make a long story short, he's now out of 250 acres, he probably plants 40 to 45 in restaurant produce. And when he was matched with the restaurant at the Harvest Festival the first or second year, the restaurant made a butternut squash bisque with a, you know, 40-year-old balsamic vinegar, blah, blah, on the top. And he ate it and loved it, and he had never liked butternut squash before. So it was so cool to me to see the commodity farmer who's really been farming all his life but never been near food, in a way, turn and taste. He was right next to this guy. They were paired together, so he got a bowl of the butternut squash soup, and he just thought it was fabulous. And I just thought, you know, farmers can taste what they're growing. Maybe that will help things along. So there's.
I don't want to respond to that.
I think that there's a lot of this, oh, the quaint farmer has the, you know, the farmhouse has is the mother of all stuff. Well, in Kentucky, they're doing crafts with glue guns, and they're, you know, and they're growing commodities, and they're not, it's not necessarily, I mean, I did a story on a woman who has a beef farm, and she wanted my tofu recipes. You know, for it was entertainment cooking for her, but it was just, it, you know, it's just not, every southern farm is different.
I wanted to say that I've worked with a lot of chefs in getting them to try different varieties of tomatoes, and we are slowly moving away from red tomatoes in Lexington to pink tomatoes because of the 32 flavor components that have been isolated for the acids and sugars in tomatoes. The yellows are very sweet, the reds are tart, and the pinks have all these kinds of combinations in between, as do the blacks and the green when ripe and the purples and the pinks especially. And when I let people taste the pink in a blind taste test, they overwhelmingly prefer them. And so we are moving almost en masse from red tomatoes to pinks in Lexington right now, and the chefs have helped lead that because they didn't take as much convincing as other people did, and then they served them in their restaurants, and then suddenly I want the tomato that I ate at American
Restaurant. That's the perfect. Yep. That's the perfect circle, as far as I'm concerned, is the restaurant table consumer. We've got to stop. We're over theoretically at 3:15. I see the next thing doesn't start till 5:30, so presumably everyone can be available for a while because I know you still have questions. Number two, of the 5,000 maps that were printed by my company for me to disperse this summer, some of them are down here. Not all of them, but I have a huge box. So if you want to see a little template of how we do it in Louisville, that you can do that. And then I guess, John, go ahead.
Thank you all so much.
One brief announcement. Remember that this evening our first talk is at 5:30, and it's at Taylor United Methodist Church in Taylor, Mississippi. It's not here. For those who are not here this afternoon and may forget, I'll have maps posted on the door for them. As you exit the door, there are goodie bags full of white lily brownie mix, white lily flour, and a koozie. There's also a map in there as well. What I have here for you is a schedule for this evening. Buses depart for Taylor at 5 from the downtown end and at 5:15 from Alumni House. If you're a fairly well-behaved participant, you're welcome to drive your car, but we do encourage carpooling because there's not much parking at all down there. If you plan on looping it up, please take the bus. And if last year's any indication, most of y'all should be on the bus. The presentation this afternoon is not to be missed. I know that as a conference drags on, the afternoon goes on, you get tired and you think, I'm going to go back and take a nap. This is going to be a slideshow by Tom Rankin on a truck farming center in Crystal Springs, Mississippi. He is a great speaker. He's compiled 70 slides from 20s and 30s that document this. It'll be a wonderful presentation. Don't miss it. Look forward to seeing y'all there. Thank you.